The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Some content in this audio is not covered under a Creative Commons license. For more information, see the course materials on the MIT OpenCourseWare website.
Okay, so today we've got a guest panel of folks from the Education Arcade, folks from the Youth Network, which is actually very closely related. These are folks, the Education Arcade is the Comparative Media Studies research group. Or based in the old Media Lab building right now. And you work with the Shadow Teacher Education Program. For folks who aren't aware of this, MIT actually has a teacher education program, so if you want to be like a certified teacher to teach, I guess,
middle school math and science. I mean, not middle school, secondary math and science. Mm-hmm.
Then you can take classes and basically get your certification or apply for your certification at the end of classes. But then they also make games. They make augmented reality games using portable devices like iPhones and Pocket PCs. Games that run on Flash together with Gambit, the prototype stuff before, and focusing a lot on games for learning. So the Education Arcade is the research group. The Learning Games Network is kind of like the spin-off company of the Education Arcade that basically sort of works on projects that will be too expensive to do inside universities, because universities are really inefficient. Anyway, maybe some, can you guys just start by introducing yourself?
I'm the latest in the group, so okay. Hi, I'm Konstantin. I come from Austria. I'm at the moment visiting researcher at the Education Arcade. I come from an educational background, so I did my PhD on learning through failure, learning through mistakes, and I kind of like worked on theories that explain why we learn through mistakes and why we most of the time don't want to learn through failure, but in games we think it's really funny or entertaining or challenging. So I was really interested in how games can be tools to understand learning, and also is it possible, or this is like one of my research questions, is it possible that people maybe learn through playing games how to cope with failure better, like even be more open to realize maybe sometimes in life we make failure and our expectations are not true, or sometimes not, maybe they are wrong. So I do research on a theoretical level with that, and do interviews with players on learning biographies, how learning experiences through games were important in their lives. And in the summer, I was happy to work for Gambit and design a game in the summer workshop. Maybe they heard about that anyway, or? Okay, so it's just like, I had 8 weeks, I was product owner on a team, and kind of like my theory was used as basis to develop a game, a learning game, called Afterland. You can play it, of course, it's free online. And I think our students did a really good job on that game, and it's a platformer where I will not tell you what it's about because then I would ruin it. But there is a twist.
Oh.
Yes, and what I'm gonna do now in the next year is, as it looks at, I try and game for a few months and do research on how the game is used by players, how they learn in the game, how they reflect on the game, and I will work with pupils and and hopefully even elderly people on that. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dan Roy. I'm a CMS alum. I did a master's and finished in 07. Worked with Philip a little bit here and there. Mostly I worked with the Education Arcade during my time at CMS and with Scott on my right. And we worked on a project called Lure of the Labyrinth, may have heard of. It teaches middle school math and literacy skills, particularly to the at-risk population, but I believe to anyone who's interested.
Free and online.
It's free and online, yep. So go play. It's better than after me.
Oh.
We'll see. Just trying to keep it interesting.
there a twist?
Is there a twist?
Yes. Well, there was not as good a twist as we originally wanted.
There was a twist in the development process. So that one was funded by the Department of Education, and that's it was a larger scale project, but the grant didn't go to MIT, it went to Maryland Public Television, so that was part of the, I believe, the impetus for the spinoff of the Learning Games Network, is to have a structure that can accommodate those sorts of larger scale projects and think about them in more sustainable ways. But I'll let Scott talk about that. So how did I get into this? My interest in learning games is mostly around engagement. I feel like people who are extremely motivated and enthralled with a particular subject will find a way to learn it, and that a game may or may not be the best way to learn anything in particular, but that there are many people out there who struggle to get interested in a topic, if they're even trying, and that a game can be useful there. So as an exploratory tool, say, well, I never really thought about history, but I like this game and I want to spend some time with it and I want to be good at it and it's social, so now I'm finding myself asking the kinds of questions that other people are telling me historians ask, and I don't know what label they want to put on it, but I think it's interesting. And just sort of having that kind of introduction to a topic. Also, I think games are helpful for, I guess I'd call it identity exploration. So for people, particularly learners who may not think of themselves as learners or as competent learners, that they can sort of put that identity behind them when they enter the game, because, you know, it's a game and anyone can play it, or maybe I'm particularly good at games, so I can play games, and then I can suddenly realize that I might be good at other things as well, or I might be interested in other things that I wouldn't allow myself to discover if whether or not I was interested, because it was a risky sphere to enter. So current projects, we're doing a language learning game. It's a casual and massively multiplayer online game with a grant targeting a population of Spanish-speaking high school students in the US. And that grant is from the Hewlett Foundation. And then we have a couple of other projects going on as well around science and some other stuff. So that's about it.
So I'm Scott Osterwald. I'm the research director of the Education Network. Research, well, I share two titles, research director and creative director, right? So of the Education Network, but also one of the co-founders of Learning Games Network. And I don't want to repeat too much of what's been said, except that I at the same time as I do this for a living, I still struggle with the term educational game, because it's not the way I think of what I do primarily. The first game I designed, before working in this setting, the first game I did was a commercial game. It wasn't designed as an educational game, it was designed just as a puzzle adventure game. It happened to be about math and logic, but that was just because that's what we thought was interesting. It got marketed because of changes in the marketplace as sort of edutainment, but when I started in the business, there was no such word as edutainment. Most games, if you go back to the early 90s, were sort of exploratory environments. I mean, either they were sort of Twitch games, or they were exploratory environments. And I have nothing against Twitch games, but exploratory environments were all about thinking and problem solving. And to me, that's what's interesting, no matter what domain you're working in, whether it's mathematical or whether it's historical, it's still, the processes are the same. And just to, the one slight twist I want to put on what Dan said, I think we're on the same page, but because he led with the idea of engagement, it's possible to think that I'm talking about games as sort of an inducement to do something you don't want to do. And I think it's games are an opportunity to discover how much fun something is, which is very different from sort of, we tricked you, you just did that. But rather, this is really interesting. Don't you like doing this? And you can do more, and then maybe, and if that, and that's all that you get out of it, that's fine. If you later realize, oh, I like doing that, and that's math, and I'm going to do more of that, that's even better. I mean, I think it's not so much because we just said it's fun, it's because I think the very process of thinking of problem solving is rewarding, and you want people to understand that better. And people do get that in games, and I just think it's important to tell people to realize if you enjoyed it in the game, you can enjoy it in life. And maybe this comes from my own realization that if when I was in sixth grade, instead of them saying scientific method and writing this list of dull steps on the blackboard, they had said, play this puzzle, and let's talk about how you solve the puzzle. That's science. I think I might have ended up working at MIT. So anyway, that's the next one.
So talking a little bit about about identifying how you're going to make some moves, how you're going to locate what's enjoyable about the thing that you wanted people to engage with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how can you talk a little bit about maybe in a recent project or even past project, how you went about that process? Let's talk about the things that you worked on. And maybe sometimes it's more difficult, then you have some challenges, maybe sometimes it's just pretty obvious.
I'll take it.
Stephanie, you both always talk.
I'd like to congratulate Scott on this personal growth. So with the language learning game that we're working on at the moment, there are approaches to language learning out there in the world that emphasize vocabulary memorization or grammar, meaning memorizing tables of conjugations. And it's pretty much stripped of any sort of meaningful context. So, and a meaningful context could either be a text, and I use that word loosely, that is engaging. It could be, you know, a film that you want to see that happens to be in a language that you're trying to learn, or it could be a means of communication. After all, that's what language is. So if you're thinking about using language as a means of communication, then of course you need to think about, well, what are you communicating? And fortunately, games are full of communication between the game and the player, and the player and the game, and if it's a multiplayer game, between the players in the game. So it was almost, like, if you start from that philosophy, it's almost a trivial exercise to say, okay, well, what's something interesting for people to talk about in a game? And then so you come up with an interesting game, and instead of having the mechanic be click this button to activate whatever, the nuclear missile, you build in collaboration. So I have part of the piece and you have part of the piece, and we need to talk about when to use what and in which context and on whom. And so suddenly we're talking, and it doesn't even feel like we're learning language, it just feels like we're playing a game. And then if you're doing it in a language that you're attempting to learn, then there's the barrier there where you might want to say something that you just don't have the skill yet to say. So it's not quite as simple as just saying, hey, go talk. But there's slightly innovative ways that you can give people tools to allow themselves to express themselves in a fairly constrained context. So because you've designed the game, you sort of rigged the system, you know that people aren't going to talk about absolutely anything. Maybe they will in the chat. But primarily in the game, you're incentivizing their discussion around a particular topic. So if you give them tools to discuss that particular topic, not only does it make the gameplay more efficient, but that's also how the learning can happen. Because there can be some sort of selection mechanism whereby I am able to say something that I want to say, but without needing to bring all of the knowledge of how to construct that on my own. There's some amount of, oh, I can just recognize that that's more or less what I want. And then by seeing it repeatedly and by seeing other players use the same tools to communicate and knowing that the communication in certain contexts is valid, that I can pay close attention to that and start to become familiar and learn. But it's
It's not a, I have to memorize it so that I can use it. It's, I'm using it, and I'm using it so much that I just naturally learn it.
Here's a question on that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're trying to encourage me to talk Spanish, and you talk Spanish, we're trying to work something out.
Yeah.
What prevents you from just typing something in English and having you read it in English?
Right, so it depends on the game. And in some games, that's totally fine. In other games, we have teams moderate other teams. In other games, we have some sort of communication tool that's not free text entry. So it's not, so one extreme is, here's a list of 10 sentences that you could say, click one of them. And that's not the direction we tend to go in, but that's an example of how to communicate something without free text entry. So there could be some sort of sentence construction kit, let's say, where you have a pool of different words that you can assemble in a variety of orders to express a small set of meanings.
And if you think about games like charades or Pictionary, the need to communicate with constraints doesn't stop us from necessarily enjoying the game if we make it interesting. So, in fact, that's part of the game. Part of our insight was thinking about our own experiences learning languages and sort of the game of, say, this gets at my sort of core idea, which is to find the game that's already there. So a game that I always play when I'm traveling, particularly when I've traveled in France where I speak the language sort of, is how far can I get into a conversation before they figure out I'm Latin American? So that becomes a game. And sort of the whole, and then how can I have it, or if I know someone who's French, how much of a conversation can we have in French? That's a game. At that point, it becomes kind of fun. So I think we were just really trying to access that. And I think that really gets back to your larger question. When you take on something new, I want to know, where is the game already in this? What, and I maybe it arrives from the first game I did was math, and a colleague with whom I co-designed the game, we both spent a lot of time saying, when we were kids, how did we play with numbers? What kind of things did we do? What was interesting to us with numbers? We really try to access our own play. And similarly now, I try to meet practitioners in the field and say, what do you think about the shower or when you're running? Where's the, because that's where the play is actually happening in the field. And I think that's where people who love their jobs, it's the play in it that they love about it. And that's what I think you try to access in any subject. So Dan talking about the language one. We're doing a game with the Royal Shakespeare Company, if we can get funding, around The Tempest. And I'm trying to figure out how to make a game of it. And I realized that part of the challenge with Shakespeare is, to some degree, the language, too, is sort of making sense out of the language, which is now somewhat archaic, but really interesting. And so we made a game that's sort of a puzzle that you assemble by finding pieces of the play and associating things. So you find a hedgehog, and you find some text that makes a reference that somehow makes you think of the hedgehog, and you put them together, and you actually start building a visual puzzle. So it's really a sort of a challenge of making sense of snippets of text that gradually grow out, and the picture of the play starts to, of the Shakespeare play, The Tempest, starts to emerge through the gameplay. So a story sort of appears out of them, the way a picture appears in a jigsaw puzzle. So it's a game you can play without knowing that ever having seen it. But that is sort of part of the experience of theater, is the way stories emerge from, they emerge in a different pattern than you do in the game, but we're still trying to make a story emerge through exploration. That was another example.
And maybe if I talk about my experience coming, I think I come from an area where we made really bad games. Like you made, there's this saying, like education games are like chocolate covered broccoli, like not healthy, not sweet, you know? And I think I come from a background where teachers or educators were asked to build games for somebody, and what you had is content. And then it was like, and I can say that because I think most of my colleagues didn't know better. They thought, okay, I have content, that content is good, and now I just make it a little fun, and the kids are gonna love it. And I think we all know how quick kids realize that this is not fun, you know. And I think there are tons of bad games out there, that ruins the reputation of educational gains in that sense. And coming here to MIT and working with Scotland and people like Dan, and that I realized more the question is more what makes us curious about a problem, about the learning content. Of course, we can have the content in the game. Sometimes we don't even have the content, it's more abstract. We look for metaphors that kind of like, you know, you can understand how to be interested in history without really learning all the real data. Maybe you learn another history, but you get interested in how history works. And I think that's kind of like what I learned here, and I realize now that it's really useful that we don't use the chocolate covered broccoli anymore. We ask more, wow, what do we really want? Do we want to have something that is healthy or sweet or something different? Let's cook it, you know? Let's not just combine two things. And I think that's something that also, like, the good educational games that are out there are kind of like heading in that direction.
Do you have counterexamples from your own work of, like, you know, something that seemed fruitful but then kind of turned out to be a dead end? When you were trying to address some subject area and then you were trying to marry some specific game mechanics, you thought it might work, but it didn't quite.
I can talk about one that it's not resolved yet, but I'm struggling. I'm struggling with a strong word, but we're doing a game with a professor here in ocean and environmental engineering about microbes. He does all his work studying microbes in the ocean, which I've learned about it. I mean, half the biomass of the ocean are microbes, and we know almost nothing about them because until people like him, which is one of the few, built apparatus to study ocean-like conditions in the laboratory, they had no way of knowing what was going on with them. So, I mean, that's interesting if you get into it. It's not something that a middle school kid is dying to know about, right? Although it could be, so we're doing a simulation where the premise is that you've got a part of the ocean that's dead and you're trying to re-engineer it by introducing nanobots, which you can build. And these nanobots would in effect simulate the functions that what microbes do, because microbes are doing it at the microbial level where megafauna does too, which is processing oxygen or rather processing either oxygen and producing CO2 and energy, or the reverse, making CO2 and sunlight. So the challenge, we made a sort of interesting playable simulation where you build the stuff, but I haven't figured out yet. I'm struggling with is it sufficiently, have we found a way to entice you to do this stuff without having to give you too much information? And I'm a big believer that this game does not start with instructions. I mean, because I don't believe games should ever start with instructions. But I'm still struggling with the information we're providing along the way, where it's too much read this now, as opposed to. And I think the problem is because simulation is very wide open environments, and it's very hard to constrain a simulation enough that the player says, now I understand what variable I just used. And particularly because kids have a tendency to see simulations as black boxes. So they'll change three variables at once and not notice that they've changed three variables and not think about, well, which variable was it. They just don't have they haven't got the habit of mind to practice changing, you know, really controlling for variables. And if you don't do that, simulations do become these black boxes. And I'm still struggling with how to sort of say, mark the kid down the road and say, okay, now make this choice, now make that choice, because that's too constrained and not fun. I want to have them have a lot of choices, but also help them understand the effect of the choices they've made. Maybe that's the best way to start. So I had to, I'm just processing this problem, so I'm not speaking in a very clear way.
I can give a bad example. So I was working on this game. Like, I wasn't really working on that, to my excuse. I was beginning to work with these people and then realized it's not the way I want to go, and then I stepped out of it, and I think it's a good example of what you shouldn't do. So this small town in Austria is using their waste to produce energy, like renewable energy. It's interesting. The town is like somewhere in the countryside, nobody was interested. They make so much power now that they can give power for free in the town to companies and the neighbor companies, neighbor companies in neighbor towns. So a lot of people are interested in how they do that, and they thought, well, we want to be a cool town, we make a game instead of just providing the content. But what they did, they gave us all the content and said, this is what you should like teach the people, and do it, make it fun. And in the end, these people were sitting together like, okay, what do people like? Comics, and you have to have a character that is moving around, and they would make small multiple choice tests, and afterwards you get a reward, and you get the reward out, and it says your name, and it says you are trained in that discipline. And what was interesting for me, that they built the game, and the game's pretty bad, and it's very sad, and it's horrible. But the funniest thing for me was, who was the target group? Like, and they never talked about that. They always thought, who cares about target groups? We make this game, everybody's going to love it, everybody's so interested. The idea was, who decides if you can do that? It's the majors of towns. They say, oh, we want to have a company like that. But, and so now we're talking about Austrian, European majors of towns. And they are normally fat and like to drink wine. Normally they sit with another major and have lunch, and then they say, wow, this works, and then they decide to do it or not. But now they were sending these games to majors. They didn't know at all what to do with this. They couldn't get into the game. And so not that the game was bad. They didn't even think about their target group. And I think that's one aspect that interests me the most is you have to have the context of the game, and the learning experience has to be suitable. If this is not happening, you can play the most interesting game. If somebody doesn't want to be doesn't get the problem, doesn't get engaged with the problem, it's just something happening. It's not really interested in that. And I think that's a major problem that this example was totally addressing. So
know who you're designing your game for, and how they tend to get engaged with things.
Yes, I think.
Just to do a simplistic example, but it's one that's apt, just as applicable. If I wanted a game for my mother, who occasionally would play a casual game, I wouldn't do a massively multiplayer game with lots of stuff going on. So all these senior citizens are going to get into this massively multiplayer game. I mean, in some ways, it would be really great if you could come up with a massively multiplayer game for senior citizens, because they're isolated. But we also know that they didn't grow up with computers, and they're not going to be able to navigate a 3D space. So that's a simplified example of why it's important to know.
What is really beautiful if like a game like Remish, the cancer game, maybe some of you know that, like a cancer game with
the reading, actually.
Hmm?
It was actually mentioned in the reading.
Okay, perfect. But it's probably one of the best evaluated learning games out there. But the good thing for them is people that play that game have cancer. And so you have the problem to the game so close that people who are playing there, oh, I don't care about cancer. No, like, they care about cancer because they have cancer. The game is about cancer and the way how chemotherapy works. So the context and the engagement is automatically kind of like the problem is solved. But what about, as Dan said, what about a learning game where it's about language learning? Are these people already interested to learn the language? Do they come there with a language problem, or do we want to introduce them to the problem, or show that maybe they don't have to be afraid to learn language or whatever? This question has to be addressed at a very, very, very early stage. Otherwise, if you start designing it and then address the question, it's late.
I do think, I mean, it's, the question is sort of about sort of the explicit versus the hidden. So if you play the Gambit game Waker, that was really designed to introduce basically an idea that people have struggled with, which are what position and velocity graphs actually mean. But the game doesn't mention velocity, and it doesn't mention graphs, and in fact, in the same reviews, that it got lots of good reviews when it came out, a lot of them said that I had no idea this was educational. I would sort of argue that that's fine, that people don't necessarily know that as they play a game, that you're still building up some conceptual knowledge. I think that some large percentage of people play a game in that setting will probably, they walk away from the game and do nothing else with it. 3 months later, it'll have gone. I mean, that experience for most people will not be resilient. not because they didn't enjoy it, but because they got lots of interesting lots of things going on in life, and there's more information coming out of something. You know, on the other hand, the kid plays that game, and then you sit down and have a conversation about velocity of position graphs, there might be some real meaningful learning that occurs. And so I think it's really important to not overreach in that sense. I try to avoid, although we slip into saying it, that our games teach anything, because I think teaching is a much more active and explicit activity than our games do. I think our games let people play with things, let people learn things, and then just like if you write a book, the book doesn't teach anything. The book puts the information where it's available. And I think that's really sort of part of what I think we have to be modest and humble about as we do this stuff. So, but that also puts on us the challenge to talk about an audience of thinking about if you do want some learning to occur, where do you want the learning to occur? Is this for people's personal lives? Is it in a mediated setting like a hospital? Or is it in a school? I mean, those are really critical questions. But it's not just the audience, but the setting for the audience. So.
And who's introducing the game to them, for instance? The teacher?
Yeah.
The doctor?
Right. And where they play it. Like with Labyrinth, which is this middle school math game that Dan and I worked on, we knew that if we didn't push in another direction, the implementation was going to be, well, we'll create this game that gets played in classrooms. If you've ever seen, if you remember your own computer labs in school, if that was your experience, which is true, actually, for a lot of your education, it meant every now and then you had to line up and walk down the hall to this other place that you could only get to occasionally, and it took, by the time you settled in your chairs and booted up, you had maybe 20 minutes on the computer, and that was time. So that was all, you know, if you're designing something for schools, you're talking about a 20-minute experience once every 2 or 3 weeks. I'm not sure that was worth thinking about anything for that day. So we designed a game we played online at home and encouraged teachers to let the kids just play. And there was another advantage of that, which was to go back to who introduces it. If you play that, even if we have a perfect 20-minute game for the computer lab, if the teacher's walking around, I mean, there's some, no, I shouldn't say, I've seen good uses of that space, but there's some greater probability that you're going to feel like this is just a lesson. Whereas if the teacher says, go play this at home, there's some greater probability that you'll sort of forget about the school and get playful. And it's not that, again, it's not that we want to trick you into doing math, it's that we want you to engage with the math in the most playful spirit possible. And the less we make it give the wrapper of school to it, the more playful you're likely to be. Even if we're not denying that it's math or science or history. So that was the part of the result of the attempt.
So Constantine, you had said that the cancer game is really well evaluated. So did any of you have stories or experiences from seeing your games out in the world that way? Like, have you gotten feedback from teachers who have tried to see the classrooms? Or was that Shango?
No.
Yeah.
No. Was it? Yes. I from the game I just talked about renewable energies. It totally failed. Mm-hmm. Like people played it and didn't understand it, hated it, or got bored. So I think like total failure. I think just to kind of like. To start with this conversation, this is a problematic thing because we hardly have any. There is very little research going on evaluation of games because it's also very hard. It takes a lot of effort and it also would take a lot of money to evaluate the research and the success of the game for learning purposes. I just know very little studies that do that in the end, and I think we just kind of like reach that moment where people start to think that this is an interesting way to do it. And remission, as I said, is probably the only. I just want, like, I hope maybe you're correct in a second, but I think that's the only game I would put my hand into the fire for it. But the question is, did they learn in the game? They learned about self agency. They learned that there is something they can do, and they learned a more positive perspective and positive relation to medicine. They didn't learn anything else, you know. That's, like, they didn't learn, like in the research, because
children didn't change their illness.
Yes, and they didn't get happier. You know, it's like not that they said, "Wow, now I can, I cannot." It couldn't cope better with their illness. They just took their medicine, And so the doctors were really happy with that. But, you know, but
And that's the stated goal of remission, actually.
Yeah.
This is a 3D game where I think you play like a woman in spacesuit or something,
yeah.
Going, you know, shrunk down and inserting someone's bloodstream. But the stated goal of the game, at least of the people who were making it, was to try to encourage people who are suffering from cancer to keep up with their medication. You know, just don't fall on your don't fail. Keeping up the schedule of taking your chemotherapy drugs, basically, and the game designed to sort of show what happens, what these drugs actually try to do, in some sort of like fictional or fantastical. I'm not going to say the fictional. Yes, all based in time. So that's remission.
Is this a free play game as well?
Yeah.
So you can Google that.
So on Labyrinth, the original grant included an extensive 1-year evaluation. Game in use, and then when Congress cut back the funding of the larger program, which Labyrinth was just one small piece, that got cut off, and so the research didn't happen. We're now looking for a grant because Labyrinth's been used aggressively in Maryland schools, even in a lot of schools, this Maryland Public Health. So we are going to look for funding, but generally there's less money, as little money as there is for developing interesting games, there's even less for researching them. And I think some of what I think our work about is design research. We figure out what we can learn by making the games, and we publish what we've learned in the hope that other people will pick up the ball, people who have more of a researcher bent, I guess, in the traditional sense, will start doing the research about it. I think we're on the brink of that. I think with stuff like the Quest to Learn School, I think increasing numbers of educators are interested in asking those questions. I do have only anecdotal evidence, but the very first game that I did, which was this math and science oriented game, a math and logic oriented game, ended up being not particularly well marketed, and nevertheless sold 1 million copies. And the anecdotal evidence I got was that it was one of those rare cases where parents would bring it in and recommend to teachers, or teachers would recommend to parents, or kids would come home from school and recommend. And there seemed to be this fairly broad acceptance by both parents and teachers and kids without kids having the sense that, oh, my teacher's making me do this. And I hear that now that those original players are in their 20s, I occasionally hear from them, and some of them say it's what interested them in math and stuff. So that's all anecdotal, and maybe every game has some cognitive support for that. But I think the 1 million copies is
meaningful.
These sales
numbers is
not anecdotal.
Yeah.
Sure. I just to add a little bit to that. I also have some anecdotal stuff around Labyrinth and some of the other games. But the most interesting thing that I've discovered was with Labyrinth and a target audience that I've seen play it that it was not specifically designed for, which is kids with some sort of attention disorder, whether it's ADD or autism or something. And seeing these kids engage with the game, even engage with the game in a social way, and be hyper-focused on the game and be highly competent with the game, and to really calm down and adopt pro-social behaviors that were not characteristic of them, or that their peers or families hadn't seen in them before. I think there's a lot of power there.
The first two teachers I met who used Labyrinth said that they were seeing performance from kids they didn't expect to see it from, which is exactly what I think we were hoping for. Because our sense was that lots of kids have competencies and skills that they don't show off in the format of school. School being its own kind of game, which only certain people are good at. And so having a kid be able to demonstrate competency at a different kind of game and let the teacher see it, because part of the design of Labyrinth is that teachers can track progress online when the kids play it. That was one of our goals. That was satisfying.
Yeah, you could probably have that sound actually. So is it possible to look it up and show some of Labyrinth?
Yeah, sure.
Because we've been talking about it in this abstract.
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't actually exist.
It's just a notion of a game.
Yeah.
Yeah, but other people can keep talking while
they're forward a little bit. The screen's going to come right off the screen.
While we're setting that up, I'd like to talk, ask a bit about prototyping. In the process of designing, these are mostly digital games that we've been talking about all the time, but I'd like to talk about, you know, sort of the early stage when you're working with paper or simple digital prototypes. Maybe we can talk a little bit about how that might be similar or different from designing other kinds of computer games or even board games. I mean, do you test it differently because you're designing it explicitly for a specific audience? Do you test it with instructors as well as players, independent players?
I think it's always best to try to test with your target audience. The things you've learned from, there's things you can learn from any audience, particularly usability, which is important. Frequently, the flaw in a game is not the core mechanic, but the ease with which the player can understand what they're supposed to do. And you can test that with any wide range of people. Anyone who you think is roughly as lit computer or game literate as your target audience. But I think if your goal is sort of to interest kids, for example, middle school kids like we were with this game, turn this on. Then you do want to, because there are questions about age appropriateness. So we're about to get the screen here. So this is just a login screen. And this is not the first screen you would come to if you'd started the game from scratch, but you get some more information about it. But I've already logged in. But you'll notice, let me just log in. So it's online, you can play from any computer. That was important because we were concerned about underserved populations who either don't have computers at home or who have less control over their time, don't have a computer in the room certainly, or might do all their work in an after-school setting or at a library. So basically you can log in from any computer. Once you have an identity, you can log in from anywhere. I'm going to briefly enter the game space, but then we're going to actually look at our puzzle too. So here, we're already in the middle of the game. This is a puzzle adventure game. The plot is someone's stolen my pet. I've tracked it down to this underground factory that's being run by monsters with the help of, remember this middle schoolers, with the help of a mysterious woman with kind of bluish skin and wings. I've been given a monster costume, so in the guise of a monster myself, I can go around and sort of do jobs at the factory, find my pet, figure out what the monsters are up to, which is indeed no good. I'm in the middle of this game, so I've already advanced some. There's a sequence of rooms, which part of the game is just finding the rooms where the puzzles are. So, for example, if I go here, there's one of the wings of the factory. There's 100 doors here, and I can click on every door if I have to, but I get a map, which is itself a mathematical tool, to find where I want to go. And as I go through each room, it's a different puzzle. Having said that, I'm going to actually go back and the other big feature in the game is that you play on teams and you can communicate with your teammates through this communicator. And the reason there is to actually get kids reading and writing about what they're doing with math. Because if you want to help your teammates, but you can't give each other the answers because you'll see we're about to play a puzzle. Every puzzle, every time you play, it's a different solution. So you can't tell each other the answer. All you can do is talk about your strategies. So it's just, I'm going to leave the game and go to puzzle mode and we'll play a puzzle. But
this is like a shortcut.
Yeah, shortcut to puzzles, right. You don't have to play in the context of the game. You can play any puzzle that you want. Well, I'm going to try one. I've never played this with a group before. So usually I pick the same game and play because I need to get used to playing with people. But let's just try this one. This will be a real level. I think I'm going to try level one. Okay, so I'm trying to remember what you know here. You have to basically, you're in the shipping area, and you've got to come up with a manifest to ship the number of objects that you've got. That's all you know. Okay? You've got to give it the right, you've got to basically give them the right instructions to ship it. And so now just tell me what to do here.
Click something.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, of course. And that's when kids are first.
It's on the bottom left.
Yeah. Dragon goes up into the.
Dragon, okay.
Yep. Up into the slots up there, as in one or zero. Or
okay.
Can we put that crazy fish head second to the right on everyone in the equal spot?
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
You want to try it in the equal spot?
I'm going with equals on this one.
Good. How do you do that? Just tell us what your thinking was.
Well, it looks like we're trying to build math equations, and usually they end with equals something.
Right. And you saw that. Now, just so you know, the equations that we're going to build, you're right, and just as a short term, this is not about arithmetic. The equations are simple. I'm not interested in drilling kids in arithmetic. This is really about the fact of number systems and that number systems are just symbol systems. But there's also some algebra that's going to go on as we start to do this, too. And at higher levels of the puzzle, this gets into other basics. So you start doing stuff in base 2 and base 6. Which sort of dovetails with the notion that our representation of numbers are just symbolic. So zero doesn't have to always mean 10. It's just a symbol. Anyway, so now what should we do?
Pac-Man should be minus, because the only ones with 6 digits have Pac-Man as the third digit.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not sure which one is Pac-Man.
Bottom right?
This guy.
That guy's Pac-Man.
Do you think that's mine?
Pac-Man with an
underline. I'm not sure if you can actually get that one there.
If you look at the top left, then what is the two-digit number that minus the last digit gives a single-digit number? So it's true minus, right?
Yeah. 24 over 4 is 6.
That's a good point. Yeah, it has to be divided by the
quantity. Yeah, see, but now what you're really doing is thinking about the structure of sort of math, which is exactly what we want.
Oh, 10 minus 1.
So when you say that's divided.
Yeah. So I'm going to guess the banana is 4.
Right, the one that was a banana. And you want to say why?
4. Oh, because, well, like using that same logic, that first equation, it's something. Nx divided by x is equal to some single number.
Yeah.
I'm guessing x is 4.
It could be 6.
By the way, you guys have not noticed a piece of information which would make your work even more.
What's that thing?
The thing at the top.
What's the thing at the top?
The thing at the bottom.
Oh, it could be 2 actually as well.
What are all the green things? Can we click on them?
Those are the things you're shipping. Those are jars of stuff. Of pet food.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Banana something banana equals something banana.
So, try banana being... banana could actually be 2, because 12 divided by 2 is 6.
Double squares.
No, I would say
banana
is
6.
Yeah,
it's 6 times 6 equals 36.
5 times 5 is 25.
True, 36
is 5. Oh, with in that respect, that means the little, the 4...
Yeah, the 4 squares is times.
Yeah,
we try that?
Yeah, it has to be 0, 1,
2. But every time you play the game, the symbols are different. I mean, the same symbols, but they're different places.
Triple dash has to be...
Yeah.
By the way, you're still missing a piece of information, but that's okay. That's what games are all about.
So what's this thing in the top left? Can we like put things in there and press enter, and will it evaluate them for us?
Yeah, but right now you're not done yet until this in yet. I'm giving you a
triple dash.
No.
Yeah, triple dash is definitely one.
Triple dash is
1.
Or right.
Oh, triple dash is 1, because 1 yeah. times banana is banana.
Unless banana is 0.
But it can't be. But then we
don't division by
banana.
Yeah,
okay, yeah, so you have 3 and
by that would be
really cool. Also, banana is 6, I think.
By the way, since I've never done this game before, the, you know, the fact that you're naming all these symbols, which of course they were just symbols. So,
banana
equals 6. I think banana is 6. I can tell that you're wrong.
I think banana is,
well,
because if banana is 5,
banana times banana,
is 0.
So banana squared is equal to something times banana.
Not something times.
No, something
so yeah, it could be 25, actually.
It could be 5. Banana
five
could be 5
or
6.
I, remember, I didn't know the solution to this when it came in, but I actually have enough data to know that you're wrong.
No,
it's
banana
on the screen.
Banana definitely is
6. No,
it could be 5
no,
or 6.
It's
5 because banana squared is
something.
It is like anchor banana. But but flower banana divided by banana is also an integer. So if flower banana and anchor banana
are
multiple of banana,
no.
then banana should be 5 and not 6.
Yes.
Because flower minus anchor times 10.
I love your math. All
right. No, that's good. So you're saying it's what?
I think it's 5.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yes.
It could work, but you could have done it in a simpler way. Or you could have surmised it, not known it, but surmised. Remember, this wasn't the first time you played. Subsequent times, you'd have other information you don't have.
He's so
oh, yeah,
guys.
Okay. Okay. The number of blocks.
The 25 thing?
The 25
thing. The 25
blocks was
the oh, so the maximum number is 25.
The anchor is 2. That's what you're actually. I'm sort of short. So normally in a group, I don't give away this one, so I'll give it away. But in fact, you're making a ship that's. That describes the thing on the pallet.
So anchor is 20.
Anchor is 2.
Yeah.
Sorry, 2.
You call this the anchor?
Yeah.
Anchors,
well,
anchors 2,
anchor, yeah,
clause 0.
Wait, where's claw?
Claw is the one on the top left. Of the squares that are left. Left.
Oh, you mean brass circles. That makes sense.
Yep.
Oh, that,
that one. That's 0. It has to be 0.
Wait, why is it 0?
Because if you look at the equation
at
the bottom right.
Oh, I'm looking at the wrong one. I'm looking at the wrong
clock.
It's definitely 0.
Star is,
it's 0.
Ninja Star is 4.
Ninja Star is 4, which means Epsilon is 5.
Wait,
is
that's
9?
A sigma, dude.
Come on.
Epsilon is 9. Oh, no, I guess it is a sigma.
Sigma is
9.
Sigma is
9. Yeah,
sigma is
9.
This is the best kind of number.
Let's see.
Wait.
Okay, so
the other
option. Scythe, look, the scythe is
what?
Scythe
what
is a plus. Scythe is plus.
No, it has
to
be minus.
Yeah. No, it has to be plus. Because something has to be plus.
Plus. Minus.
And then the crescent moon dot.
The banana is 3.
Oh, that's banana. Yeah,
banana.
Yeah,
that's
3.
That's 5.
That's the other banana.
Yeah.
The sticks is minus.
No,
I'm not talking about that one.
Yeah,
the backwards C has to be the triangle.
Does that curious anyone who is having trouble and this happens in the group, and so please anyone have trouble following it as people were making stuff up, were finding stuff? Because if you did, it's okay. In fact, sometimes you got to play the game yourself for it to make sense. So I can stand in front of a crowd. I could have told you. I actually think I could have told you a lot about the game going into it. And there would still be a high probability that when you started playing it, you would have not absorbed anything I'd said. That's my experience. I can almost divot a wall away, and people still don't get it until they play it.
So theta
double. Just talks about the value of play.
Theta doubles out upside down is 8.
So we're working on that.
No, not really. Actually,
I'm talking about how many kids are there.
Would we enter that now?
All right.
Oh, so now you have to type in 1 times whatever equals.
You have to type in what this is. So, and this actually is getting at an alternate, another representation.
So let's see.
8 plus 9
is
17. All right, let's try that. And then here you don't actually have to remember the English.
8 plus.
Right. 8 plus?
You say 8 times.
Just divide by 6.
Right?
Yeah.
It's puzzle mode.
So 56.
Yeah, and by the way, it can take it in either order.
Yeah, I agree. I think this equals 56.
I think there's only addition, and this level is only addition in the book. You can move the addition at the top.
Yes,
you can come up with a way of representing subtraction and division.
2 plus 8.
2 plus 8.
Yeah.
Or we could do 10 minus 2.
Anyway, I just pointing out that when you were solving that, you were doing algebra.
1 to 10 minus 2.
When you were solving for those numbers, you were doing algebra. You were really sort of thinking about X and the structure of the math and the numerical quality of it. And like I said, now this is simpler, but it's still getting at the fact that there are multiple ways of representing numbers and quantities.
Is there any mechanic to prevent like brute force?
You run out of, yes, those lights go out. You run out. But you do earn points along the way in the game if you make some progress. And so we try not, none of these puzzles are brick walls, because you can always play multiple puzzles at once. You can leave this puzzle, go to another puzzle. And if you do make any progress at all, you're accumulating points toward the end of the game. You can actually get to the end of the game story without having solved any puzzles. It takes a long time. The rewards are there for doing well. And there are rewards for doing well, but there isn't punishment for not doing well. There isn't sort of a, we don't say you can't, we don't make you sort of stop it in your tracks.
You can do it again.
Yes, that's right, you can do it again instantaneously. And there's no cost, there is no cost in the game to having failed repeatedly. It's not, if you eventually solve it, you end up with the same score whether you solved it on the 20th time or the first time. This, that's, but really, problem solving in math is not about being the fastest. It's just about learning how to solve things. Speed is overrated, and in math, it's much greater than overrated. You know, big kids think they have to be able to do calculations in their heads. Anyway, I don't want to go on. I mean, it's just more of this. And then higher levels, we do have come up with we came up with representations of subtraction, which is that you have like a large number, like you have 10 jars and 5 of them are empty, so it's 10 minus 5.
Oh,
how is division?
Are they 10 rows of jars? Rows are empty?
Yeah, it's the same. I think that's it. I think that's the same. It's in a grid pattern with some of them. So.
And how would you do? I guess there's an algebra in there, but do you have any algebra such in this like format?
But we encourage is that. So what comes with this is material for teachers to relate this to the curriculum. And what we really want to happen is the kids have played the game before they get the subject. When the teacher introduces symbol systems or base 6 or whatever it is that relates to this, instead of saying, all right, start up a new unit, you again know nothing, you're starting again at square one and have to start all over again with something new. Instead, the teacher comes in and says, I want to introduce a new concept, but it's one that you've really already begun to master. And it's called bases, and it pulls up the higher level of this game. So how did you solve this? What was going on in this game? And they have a conversation about what they already know as a way of leveraging what, I mean, things that I arguably don't know. I mean, I would argue that the way we deal with bases, by the way, is you have boxes, you have things in cartons. So a carton of 6 jars plus some left over would be a carton of 6 jars plus 3 left over would be 1/3 in base 6. So anyway, the point is that the kids begin to build up this sort of robust conceptual understanding, and hopefully with a sense of playfulness of that, so that when the teacher talks about it, it's something they actually feel kind of good about. Instead of, here's one more reason you'll never be a mathematician. I think math education is largely designed to gate everybody, so that at the end of the high school, only 7% of the population thinks they're good at math, which means that we've taken 12 years teaching 93% of the population they're no good at math, and they should stop doing it. And I don't know why we waste 12 years, we could just tell them to go to kindergarten. But that's sort of what we end up doing. Anyway, I think that's true with every subject in high school. It's happened to know the number of mathematics. So I'd like to turn it around where everyone says there's things about math I can do, no matter where they end up. So.
identity of Brooklyn, the prototyping for this one?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit maybe about how that process went?
Sure. I also just wanted to provide a little extra nuance to one of the questions about what if you just brute force your way through it. In the higher levels, it won't tell you when you put a symbol in a slot whether it's correct or not.
Yeah.
So.
Which actually you can learn something kind of interesting because you can start doing something and suddenly it's like where you do a Sudoku
well,
and suddenly you end up with a long right. Something that doesn't add up. That's actually a meaning. You're learning something.
Right. So there's 10 puzzles or how many?
Nine
puzzles, and we came up with 9 plus X, and some of that X was slated for implementation and we never got there, and some of that X was puzzles or activities that we ended up deciding were not as compelling as the others. And our process for that, we did a hybrid approach with paper and computer prototyping. And in general, the rule is if it can be paper prototype it. It's so much faster. But there are certain kinds of activities that really can't. So for instance, this one is perfect for paper prototyping. Just take out a piece of paper and a pen, and you create, you have to create some of these equations so that you then have a system of equations to solve. But once you've created some of those data sets, which would need to be done whether it's a paper or a computer prototype, then it's trivial to put it in front of someone with paper. So this is an example of something where we would, for the first round, test internally with just symbols and numbers. And then probably we might even test that version with people in our target audience, but probably we would try to do some rudimentary art treatment before we put it in front of people, just so there's a little bit of context and it looks a little bit more like a game. And then in general.
And sometimes we try to, if there's story, this one has less story about it, but if there's story about it, as you are in some puzzles, we actually try to act it out. You have to sort of get over your resistance to doing that. Sort of act out the character, even if it's you're the computer when you do it, and so even if it's just a character giving a response to something that the player does, you try to do it in character. You try to get a sense of what, because I think even in that kind of rudimentary form, you are engaged in the player's imagination, so
right.
You know whether or not they're sort of interested in this character or the idea. So,
so like I think as a dungeon master,
right,
a lot like that,
yeah.
And like a dungeon master, you need to prepare because it's hard to be the computer without also being the bottleneck if you're a human.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, we've done some games, not represented here, we've done some games that are real time that if you want to prototype with people, then especially on paper, and you want to keep things moving, then you need to have more than one person be the computer because there's just too much to track for one person to do it all. Or if you want to do, sometimes we do hybrids where we'll do a computer prototype, but there's aspects of the game that are not represented through the interface or that logically we haven't modeled, and so we'll do, you know, players directing human interactions with the computer, or I guess not players, designers influencing those interactions. So anyway, this is a game that moved pretty much all the way to final design on paper and then went straight to implementation. Some of the other games, so for instance, there's a game, do you want to show bats, maybe?
The bats, yeah.
That's an example of a game that's a little bit harder to think about playing just on paper.
Yeah, so I just want to think, we implemented this early.
Yeah, we did. So this is a game about modular arithmetic and common multiples and that sort of thing. So it's very hard to see on the screen. In the upper left, there is an avatar.
There's you.
Me.
That's
not
my character. And you know from the story that your goal is to get these golden eggs and avoid this guy. That much you know. And that you're in a factory where they mix stuff, so.
Let's put in.
Do you move your avatar?
One and two mix that.
What?
What?
It's
one in three. Oh, with 11. No, 11.
All right.
I get you where you
Yeah, okay.
There is one flaw, by the way, in the which I thought they had fixed in the interface. People don't realize they're gonna have to click to get their guy onto that thing. And it was supposed to start with it keyed up right where he was, so that people would go to the click. Because now, if I where what should I try now?
Four.
I'm gonna go six.
Four and nine.
Wait, four.
What?
Why four?
Why four?
Six.
Yeah, six. Six.
Six.
Four.
Four.
Why four?
Four.
Six. Then you can move and get the end.
Okay. I'll go for six.
Bam.
Four is
stuck at the top.
Oh, can we move?
But you'll notice that these bats all have different amounts, and so it's really about modular arithmetic. So what's 12 will take me once around on one of them, but it'll take me more than a third around on another one. And you start doing simultaneous equations to solve this. This level is hard. I think maybe the hardest puzzle to design the whole game is level three of this, where you've got to, every step you've got to align two bridges.
Oh, that sounds fun.
And it's serious work.
Are you trying to avoid that monster?
Yeah, you've got to avoid the monster.
Okay.
Which isn't always hard, but you have to sort of keep in mind, sometimes it means instead of going around once, like nine, instead of going one on the nine thing, maybe you go 10, and he'll always go onto the bridge if it shows up. So maybe that'll cause another bridge to show up and get him out of your way.
So this is really about the Chinese remaining thing.
About what?
Yes.
Anyway, again, it's not, you can play a game without thinking about math at all. There's no school math in this game. But I think there's sort of really interesting things to think about.
But I think I want to highlight what you just said with the character, if he walks or not. Like, I think if we, for us, it's clear anyway, but you have to keep in mind there are two forms of learning. One is learning the game, how to play the game.
Yeah.
The other one is learning, like, the problem solving or the puzzle in the game. And I think it's sometimes, especially with my experience in educational games, it's so easy to mix it.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes you make the coolest educational game and it's really interesting, but you know, like, for instance, the character wouldn't move if you don't press the mouse button. So it would always stand there in the beginning and it would get that effect, you know?
Right.
And I think the mixture of both forms of learning is quite interesting to keep in mind when you're prototyping.
Yeah, and it's actually, there's two answers to that. One is, I never think, just because you want people to think hard, I don't think the interface should be the thing they have to think hard about. It's always tempting to say, oh, that's really good and tough, that's a really hard thing to solve. How do I make them jump? But no, I mean, I think generally it should not be hard to figure out how to make them jump, or how to make them walk left or right, or how to open a door, or, you know, unless that's a puzzle. And it's easy to delude yourself that by making the interface hard. On the other hand, there is this other challenge, which is that kids do have different degrees of sort of literacy around games, and it's hard to figure out what the sweet spot is. That's one I don't have an easy answer for. Because some large percentage of the audience naturally knows, you know, try to get to the end, try to, you know, knows what winning means. But there's some kids who don't. And the question is, if you bend over backwards, like if I was trying to do this, I watched my mother play this, and it was horrible. Because she just was totally clueless about where to go with this. But I think if I tried to set up the game to work for my mother, it would only work with all this explicit instruction. Hopefully with kids, it's less of an issue. There's more, I think, uniform game literacy. But it's always a challenge. No game appeals to everybody. And you do want... I don't think those of us who make learning games have a good answer to that. I don't think we can ever make a game that every kid would play with equal fervor. And we should never claim that we're going to get 100% on that.
One thing that I know that you've noticed is the amount of tolerance that kids and adults have for frustration. When I've seen kids say, I hate this game is too hard, and they'll just keep going at it. Whereas adults have this tendency to get really embarrassed if they can't solve it first time.
It happens when you're 26. You suddenly sit down and say, well, I'm not very good at this. people who were, you may have been a gamer all your life, but it's what having another adult watching you. I don't know, there's some point in life when you suddenly say, oh, I'm not good at this. I don't know why it happens, but it hasn't happened in film.
I'm useful, not knowing what number.
Can you do negative numbers?
Not on this one, no. That's a good idea, though. That's an interesting thought. Yeah, we didn't think about negative numbers.
Well, you could, in modular arithmetic, you could always do it as just put in a larger number instead
of
a
right.
Number.
That's right.
I have a question for Constantine, because so far we've been hearing from you guys about coming more or less from a game design angle into designing games for a specific learning purpose. And you kind of came the other way around. Mm-hmm. You came in from the education pedagogy side. Mm-hmm. And are there things to keep in mind when you're working across disciplines that you'd like game designers to know?
Yeah, so I think one difference that I still have or see between the way I approach games and the way educational games approaching games is I'm more focusing on learning as an experience, like more in abstract form. That doesn't mean that I would be interested in that, but that's not what I've been working on yet here. So for instance, in Afterland, it was, so the research question was, how can players overcome expectations that are wrong? And I didn't, so the idea was not to use educational stuff, like numbers or whatever, but more, can we develop patterns in games that players realize very quickly, and are they ready to give them up if they realize that they think what they've seen is wrong? So for me it was very interesting because I come with an abstract theory inside, and then so we were developing prototypes, and it's very interesting when you come from the abstract idea to prototypes. And I thought paper prototyping is perfect because it really, you know, like it made me as a scientist come to the ground, you know, like because I can, of course, I can read Husserl and all these people and say, wow, experiences this and that, and then you suddenly have pen and paper and sit there and think about a game that kind of like is a metaphor for your theory. And so I think my takeaway was that paper prototyping was very healthy for me, and with the team to come down to the fact what is really doable in the game, what can we really, I think, and in the beginning I was a bit like, being not that experienced in prototyping, like, wow, we can all do that later, we can do the cool stuff when we get to programming, but then I realized, no, we can't, you know, if we cannot do it as a paper prototype, how should we do it, you know, like in programming, what is changing, you know, and I think for us it was very interesting, I think one experience we had is, we had them develop different prototypes, and so I think that was healthy for us, not to make one paper prototype and then think how we can do it better, but that's what education kid anyway makes, a lot of prototypes, you know, like and to stay open, and even if you spend like 3 or 4 days on a prototype, if it doesn't work with others the moment you show them and they go like, what, like these are the rules, are you sure? I don't get it, you know, and if you explain it a 10th time, maybe, you know, it was a cool idea back home or with your friend, maybe it just doesn't work, you know? And so this kind of like experimenting with prototypes was very healthy for us. And then coming to the point, and I realized for me it was important that somebody coming in the room and playing a prototype for 5 minutes kind of like understands the core mechanic. If this is not happening, you know, like who takes the 5 minutes to understand the core mechanic, you know? Nobody today.
I mean, like in this game, like walking onto a ring.
Right.
On the
yeah. Yes. Right. That's right.
And so, yeah, I think coming from a different perspective, again, prototyping is kind of like the way to get in the game, you know, even as the designer, because from then on you know what you're talking about. And I had to lose a lot of my abstract thoughts in the process, and then the playtesting, you know. So it was interesting sometimes to see, even if the prototype is cool, then you have a prototype, and then people come in and say, I'd get it again, and you go like, can't be true, you know, it's so easy. But then, you know, you can start to stick with your idea or say no, if maybe I have to go down with the theoretical aspect and really look what is doable for the players.
So another thing about prototyping, it's not focus groups. So it is not a case of, it's true you want to do it and put it in front of as many people as possible, but you really want to, I think, avoid stuff like what did you like, what didn't you like. those kind of questions, because people want to be helpful, and sometimes when people say they didn't like is actually the part where they were working hardest. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, I didn't like that I had to jump over the wall. Well, in fact, that thing, you have to jump over the wall. And it may not really mean that if you took that out, that they would enjoy the game more. In fact, they might not enjoy it at all. So you have to be really careful about that. And people want to please you, so they'll say, oh, it's good, and stuff like that. I think it's really important that what you do with prototyping is watch the player, and then trust yourself as a designer. Rather than ask them what you should do, because they'll try to be helpful, and they'll come up with wrong suggestions. Watch them and try use your best judgment as a designer as to what they're reacting to and why they're reacting the way they are, and try to fix it. And maybe ask them, try to get some questions, to try to maybe get some access to their thinking, but don't think that they necessarily know what was interesting to them or what would make them happy. Don't ask those questions. Those are focus group questions, and you shouldn't ask them because it's not going to give you the answers you want. You got to trust yourself at some level as you want.
And something that I also had to learn was, if you have to focus test or the play test and then you realize there are problems, and it's really healthy to write down the problems and then brainstorm different solutions. Don't ever, like when you discuss it, try to come up with a solution immediately, because what happens is you quickly develop one solution and then you go in with another problem, but then you don't realize that sometimes, you know, like some problems stick together. Or sometimes you realize, well, we have so many problems just because of this little aspect we have in the game. Why don't we just hit it, you know? And if you don't do that, you spend 2 hours on solving a problem, then realize it was wrong, or you never realize it again. So kind of like stick more to the problems and quick solutions to where you are still movable, and not make solution, and then have the same problem a few weeks later again.
And I just want to clarify, focus test and focus focus group, two very different things.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking, the kind of results you're talking about, focus testing,
yeah.
which is specifically identifying individual problems in your game.
Yeah.
And focus group is asking them what they liked, which is actually very not useful for most product design, in fact, games in particular.
One piece of advice, because you're all, I think it's really important if you're a smart college student, like an MIT student, is that you probably learned in spite of your education. You learned by having someone sit in front of the class and tell you what was going on, and you somehow absorbed it. And that's why you got here. But lots of people don't learn that, and it's really hard to avoid the tendency in the game to just tell people what they should know, which is sort of, for my money, like when you meet someone who speaks a foreign language, and so you not understand each other, so you both start speaking slower and louder. To no effect. And I think that's what a lot of education, that's what a lot of bad education in general does, is it speaks slowly and louder. And certainly a lot of bad educational games do so. So, and just remember that just because you got it the first time that someone told you doesn't mean that everybody else, it's not just about explaining it better. It's about giving them a different way of learning.
Any questions for our guests?
I just wanted to say something. Have you ever heard of Firehose Games? I just posted this on the forum. So I told them, I know a guy works there, and he said we got focus group tomorrow night, or PS3 set release in a few months. And does anyone want to go tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, so an hour, hour and a half?
That includes NRK and Gambit alums are part of
Firehose
Games. Are they looking for people who haven't played the game before?
Maybe.
What game?
Probably.
Can I ask a question? Can I ask for this?
Just email me or let me know in the next year as it comes
out. So the question I would have for you is this, did anybody of you have in his play biography an educational game that you played that you would say was kind of like an important experience to you? That even, you know, like, I know maybe it's embarrassing now with the other ones are listening, but is anybody out there?
Was it like Zambonis, whatever that game was?
Best game of all time.
It was similar in that you had like an avatar that you're taking around and had to solve little puzzles that, you know, underlying them was math. And like simple math equations, but like with us, it was like
pizzas, like you just divide up pizzas, cool.
It was awesome.
We can't let that slide. That's Scott's game.
I was going to ask you, because that sounds exactly like
Thank you, Master.
No, but I think it's interesting to think about, if you had an experience like that, what was it that made you like the game? You know, like, I think it's very rich, because a lot of people have bad experience with educational games and then think about them when they design it. Think about the good ones. But, yeah.
There was this series of games called Thinking Things, and one of them had a mode that basically was kind of like programming, in that you could place different types of units on a grid and then give them instructions in a loop. So say go forward, then left, then right, and they could paint a square. And so what you could end up doing is, with a certain configuration, a certain set of rules, you could get them to draw patterns and stuff like that. And what used to happen is my dad would say, "Can you get two like inverted triangles drawn on the screen?" And then I would like sit there and try to like basically program without realizing that it was actually a programming game. So.
But they made it a game, which is sensible. There's a bunch of games that have done that. The last puzzle ones and beings actually did some of that stuff too. And there's a product out just now called, that I'm hooked on right now, called TrainYard, which is on the iPad, the iPhone.
Yeah, I thought that would be your game.
What?
I thought that would be your game.
Yeah, and it really is about, it really is a programming game, basically. It's kind of cool.
Robuzzle is a programming game. The iPhone version is coming here on the IT kit.
I was just going to say that two games which are really informative for me, like in the educational context, were Dinosaur Discovery, which is an ancient game. I would have played it when I was in kindergarten, and I'm older than most of the people here, but I won't trust. And it was an adventure text puzzle game. Which was kind of neater. And then Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Another classic game that I played back when, I think it was back when, about the time when the internet started getting popular, it was mid-90s, it was Math Blasters or something.
Mario teaches typing, that's how I'm going to type.
Oh wait,
Mario teaches typing.
That was important.
Mario's time machine.
The Incredible Machine.
That was what I was
doing. The Incredible Machine.
The Incredible Machine.
Yeah, yeah. That's like the thinking thing. That's really,
I love that game. That's a great game. And I think this comes from Diva, because even this romantized, wow, that back in the good days, you know, like I really enjoyed that game. That's kind of like, I think, where we all want to head to with educational games. It's not like, oh my gosh, you know, I have to play an education game, but more, they can be really.
I think the best about comics and Diva was it came with an almanac. They encouraged you to do research, in effect.
Yeah.
In fact, it wasn't cheating to look up the answers. It was smart to look up the answers.